All right. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today as we continue our series of reading Luke backwards. Last week, Eric delved into Luke chapter 20, and today we're going back further into Luke chapter 14. So please, without further ado, please help me welcome Eric Barreto, New Testament professor at Princeton Theological Seminary.
Awesome. Thank you all. Appreciate it. Good morning, friends. Good to see you all. Thanks for coming back. Oh, wait. There we go. All right. Good to see you all. These habits die hard.
You don't even
want a grade. Right, no grades here, yeah. If you were, you'd all be in trouble. No, I'm just kidding, no. Just a review about where we've been. So in the first week, reading Luke backwards, we started with Luke's account of the cross, stressing especially the spectacle of the show, the spectacle of the cross, and the distinctive way that Luke imagines the place of the cross as a tragedy in which God intervenes. And last week we read a couple texts. I think the one of the most misread texts, and maybe the second misread text, we talked about Caesar and God, render unto Caesar. And then we also talked about the text of the widow's mite at the beginning of Luke chapter 21 as well. Any questions or thoughts, anything lingering over the first couple of weeks, or anything that popped in your head as you thought about these texts, as you were going along your everyday lives? Anything that stood out to you, struck you as you were thinking about these texts? One thing I thought about this week as you're thinking is, I don't know if you remember, the first week I showed you a couple different images, and several of you came up afterwards and asked me why I didn't include an image from Ukraine as an example of some of the ways that the cross and the tragedy is refracted through our everyday lives and through the world. And I said I hadn't found the right picture, but I saw one this week that I, if I teach about this again, I'm going to use. I don't know if you saw this picture. I think it was in Lviv. It was a square with 109 strollers laid out in on the block there, representing the number of children who've been lost in the conflict. And I thought that captured that well, the sense of innocent people caught in the midst of an imperial conflict. Caught in the middle of that, and the tragedy that that represents. But others, any questions or thoughts, anything that you noticed in before we jump into our text for this week? Marvelous. Great. Oh, I should go on? Great. All right, great. One of the first things you learn in teaching, and there's a couple teachers who you know this, right? Like, when you first start teaching, you ask a question, and you think that it's been like 5 minutes and nobody has said anything, but really if you timed it, it's been like 2 seconds. Like just getting comfortable with the silence is half the battle as a teacher, just sitting there. And sometimes I tell my students, I'm being paid to be here, so I don't know about you all, but I'll just wait in silence so y'all say something. All right, two overarching insights that we'll wrestle with this morning as we think about our text. One is the importance of meals in the Gospel of Luke. So if anybody has been hearing me teach for the last couple of years, we've talked about this, but I just want to reiterate that bit of this. That for Luke, the meals that Jesus has are not just settings for Jesus to say stuff. They're not just kind of like adornment, background adornment for the things that Jesus is going to say and do, but that the meals themselves, where they happen, with whom they happen, are embodiments of the good news. They're instantiations of what salvation looks like, feels like, and even tastes like. That eating, gathering, dinners, these are not just settings for Jesus preaching, but an instantiation of the shape of salvation, an embodiment of salvation. They're not just examples of salvation. They're kind of what salvation is supposed to feel like, what the experience of salvation is like. There are these pictures that show us what salvation is not just as a future reality, but as a present reality for us right now. You'll remember that early in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is called a glutton and a drunkard, which apparently is an insult, but it makes me want to hang out with Jesus that much more. There's something about his life and the kind of abundance of eating and drinking that is not incidental to his character, to who he is. There's something about that breaking of bread that marks Jesus' ministry according to Luke. And one of the places we see that is at the end. So I know we started backwards, but at the very end in Luke chapter 24, on the road to Emmaus, when Jesus is walking with these two friends who've been traumatized by what they've seen happen to their friends, so traumatized that they can't recognize him when they're right next to him. And they recognize him not when he talks, not when he's walking beside him all day, not when they can reach over and pat him on the shoulder, but when he does the most Jesus thing that Jesus does in all the Gospels, is that to eat, break bread, and share it with his friends. That's when their eyes are opened. So that's one set of realities that we're dealing with our text this week, is the importance of meals, not just as settings of for the gospel, but its very embodiment, its very instantiation. The second thing we want to deal with is Jesus' parables. And I want to suggest to us that the parables are a problem for us. In this way, is that if you've grown up in the church, if you spent some time in the church, if you've been around the church for a while, you've heard all the parables. You know how they end. And through years and years of sermons and people like me talking from behind this pulpit, you know what the parables mean. But that's a problem for us. We think we know what they mean. We're no longer surprised by the parables. We're no longer alarmed by the parables. We're no longer offended by them. They are domesticated in our memories. And if you remember the first week, we talked about finding the rough edges of the cross. I think in some ways we have to find also the rough edges of Jesus' parables. Because when Jesus told these parables, they were really disruptive to people. They offended people, they bothered people, and made people like bend their head over sideways and wonder, what in the world are you talking about, Jesus? When we hear the parables, we're like, ah, I know where this one's going. I know this parable. I know the ending. Part of the power of the parables is that they mess with us. And stuff that we know, stuff that we've memorized, interpretations that we assume don't tend to mess with us. So our text today intersects around these two insights, the importance of meals for Jesus as these embodiments of salvation, and the way that parables are supposed to mess with us, the way that parables are supposed to disrupt us and make us see the world a little bit differently. So let's start in looking at chapter 14. So this is a bit before our text itself, the parable of, often in the Bibles, they're called the Great Dinner. I don't think it's all that great, but I'll tell you why here in a second. So this is right before that context. So this sets the context for the telling of the parable. So when Jesus noticed how the guests chose the places of honor, he told them a parable. Something that Jesus does frequently, almost habitually. He's a storyteller. When you are invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not sit down at the place of honor, in case someone more distinguished than you has been invited by your host. And the host who invited both of you may come and say to you, give this person your place. And then in disgrace, you would start to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down at the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. For all who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. He said also to the one who had invited him, so here Jesus is eating with other folks, as he tends to do, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, in case they may invite you in return, and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the disabled, those unable to walk, and the blind. And you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So here Jesus is messing with these folks. He's messing with their assumptions about the kind of gathering that ancient people do around tables. Pursue places of honor? No, pursue a place of humility that you might be brought up. Invite those who can repay you? That's the kind of ordinary, everyday assumption about what you do? No, invite those who cannot pay you back. Here embedded are assumptions about the ways that reciprocity and friendship and meals work in the ancient world. The people that you gather with, the people you associate yourself with, reflect something about who you are. So therefore, when you invite somebody to your home in the ancient world, and perhaps a little bit in our world too, you are associating yourself with that person and creating even some forms of social debt, right? So he says, don't invite people who can invite you back, because then your debt is repaid. You're all at zero. Instead, he says, go and invite people who cannot invite you back, because then your reward will come not from your friends with social status, but from God, God's self. So again, Jesus here is messing with their assumptions about eating, about gathering. But something else is happening too that I think it's worth us talking some about, and that's the language around disability in the text. So you'll notice the brackets. So I changed the translation there from the NRSV. So the NRSV uses the word lame and the word crippled to talk about these folks. And that's just not language that at least I tend to use in everyday life to talk about people. The only time I ever hear those terms anymore are usually in church, weirdly, not in everyday life. So the NRSV has gone through this small revision. It's called the updated edition. And some of this language is coming out just to kind of reflect our own practices of everyday life. So just wanted to point that out for us to notice the way that, you know, it's a 30-year-old translation and our own language has shifted in those 30 years. So I think that's one thing to notice. But more importantly, I worry here about the sense here that maybe Luke's Jesus has not given enough credit to the poor, the disabled, those unable to walk, and the blind. The assumption here being is that they cannot repay you in any way. Now, I might try to save Jesus here a bit and say, okay, what Jesus meant is that they, in the ancient world, folks like this, those categories of folks did not usually have the financial resources to create a dinner situation or party situation to pay back the kind of abundance that you might share with them. But I think it's worth us thinking about, too, the ways that when we think about even these categories of folks today, we tend to not give the poor and the disabled a whole lot of agency, I think, even in our own practices. Even as we've gotten better about using better words for folks, we often don't give them enough agency. But I think it's worth us thinking about that as well. So Jesus here is asking, what's a dinner for? Why do we have these dinners and these gatherings? It's not for those seeking honor or for those seeking to accumulate social credit. These dinners, these gatherings, are for those who need to be fed, for those who can least afford the social calculations of hierarchy, those who simply need to eat and to belong. So here, Jesus disrupting their sense of what it means to gather, and perhaps, if we're honest, disrupting our sense a bit about what it means to gather. Jesus tells a parable. All right, Jesus, I think we get it, but somebody in the audience doesn't get it, and I think we as interpreters often haven't gotten what Jesus just said either. And this is where we get to our text. So one of the dinner guests, on hearing this, on hearing the parable that Jesus tells, and the instructions Jesus gives about why we gather and who you should invite and how you might imagine yourself being repaid by God in the end instead of by your neighbors and your friends, one of the dinner guests hears all this and says, "Blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." And then Jesus, I think, tells another parable to drive the point home. It's not really about blessing. It's not really about the bread. It's about the gathering. So Jesus tells another story. Someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his enslaved person to say to those who have been invited, "Come, for everything is ready now." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, "I have bought a piece of land and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets." Another said, I bought 5 yokes of oxen and I'm going to go try them out. Please accept my regrets. Another said, "I've just been married and therefore I cannot come." I think one of the things we may miss about this litany of excuses is how terrible they are. It's like the worst thing would be, I can't come to your party, I'm washing my hair. Is that still a thing? I remember like that was like the excuse, right? Like the stereotypical excuse. I don't know if we say that anymore, but these terrible list of excuses, you wonder what is wrong with this guy's friends. Their excuses are so flimsy. Maybe the dog ate my invitation would be another list of the terrible reasons, but these are not good friends. There's something about this that's really ludicrous, that's fabulous, that's just silly. That this litany of friends just keeps saying, no, 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 I know you invited me. I know you got all the food together. I know you sent an enslaved person to come get me, but I have other things I need to do. I'm not coming to your party. The landowner's generosity is met with disinterest, and that disinterest here shortly is going to be met with anger. What is wrong with this guy's friends that they refuse to come? So the enslaved person returned and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and said to the enslaved person, go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the disabled, the blind, and those unable to walk. So it's no accident, right, that the same list of people that Jesus says that you're supposed to invite are now listed here as the people that the owner of the house invites once he has been slighted, once he has been rejected, once he has become angry. And so I wonder, not just what's wrong with this guy's friends, I wonder what's wrong with this guy. He gets so angry at this. His friends don't like him. He has a bunch of stuff, but apparently nobody's love, nobody's affection. Nobody wants to come to his dinner. What's wrong with him? I also wonder what Jesus is trying to do here. Why is he messing with me with this story? Why does Jesus put a story before us with a master no one likes and an enslaved person who has to do his bidding? Am I okay with a story about a master and a slave? Can such a story be instructive for us today? Why is this story messing with me like this? So the enslaved person said, sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room. Then the master said to the enslaved person, go out into the roads and the lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner. So the dinner is so great, so expansive, so abundant that the enslaved person goes out and finds a bunch of people at the margins of that community. In the Greek, it's something like, go out to the narrow places and the wide places, the near places and the far places. This sense of the enslaved person has looked everywhere, and there's still room left over. That's the abundance of the great dinner, a dinner that he invited, you know, maybe just three people to, or three sets of families, right? The three sets of families says we are not able to come. There's so much food that he can feed all these people at the margins of the community, and there's still room left over. So, he says, go out into the roads and the lanes, the narrow places and the wide places, the near places and the far places, and I think compel is a little soft, force people to come to my party. He's here working not out of love or about abundant generosity. He's still angry that he was slighted by his supposed friends. Make them come to my party. Why? So that my house may be filled. Again, I wonder what's wrong with this guy whose soul is so broken that he's willing to go have an enslaved person go find a bunch of people in the community and force them to come to a party so that his soul might be filled and perhaps his house too. And then he continues, for I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner. Those people who rejected me, who said they had something better to do, had these terrible excuses, never again will they taste my food. It's not for them. I have a lot of questions at this part of the text too, right? So when it comes to the disabled folk or the poor or the people that were compelled, they have a choice in the matter? Maybe somebody who's blind or disabled didn't like this person either and didn't want to come to the party? Did they have a choice? Were they invited or were they compelled to come? Did they have a choice in this question, or did a powerful person exercise that power to fill his house and eat the food that he made for his guests? Is this a story about invitation and generosity, or about a powerful person getting what they want? And I wonder, too, about the way that this parable ends. None of those who were invited will taste my dinner. And I start wondering, wait, is that me, Jesus? Did I miss your invitation? Did I reject you without knowing? Is this talking about us, about me and you, Jesus? Am I still invited? Is my invitation still good? So we have at least two challenges with this parable. One is that we've heard it a bunch of times before. And in the Bible, in your study Bibles, if you have it, it's right at the top there. It's called the Great Dinner. That's where Jesus starts. He calls it a great dinner from the very first. So it's got to be a good dinner, right? But maybe that great dinner is meant to disrupt our sense of what a good dinner looks like. But second is that we have a tendency to read parables like allegories, that every character in the parable has a role to play and that we can correspond that character and that role to us and to God. And notice our tendency, at least my tendency, that when I'm reading parables and I hear about someone who's got a bunch of power, someone who can enslave other people, someone who can throw a great dinner, I tend to associate that kind of person with God. And less often do I associate God with the poor, the disabled, the blind. And maybe that's a problem with my own approach about how I think about the character of God. Moreover, the second problem is that not all parables are allegories. So there are times when Jesus says, this represents that. He does that with the parable of the seeds being strewn on the ground. But I think part of the power of parables is that they don't mean just one thing. And I think even Jesus' interpretation of the different seeds strewn on the ground is only one interpretation of that text. Too quickly, what we've done with this text, I think, is assume that God must be the master, and we are the people either that rejected the invitation or we are people on the margins who happen to be compelled into this party. But if we go back, I think there's lots of reasons to think that the master that the story starts with doesn't sound a lot like God, and certainly doesn't sound much like the Jesus of the Gospel of Luke. Number one, because you remember one of the things that Jesus gets accused of doing all the time is eating with all the wrong kinds of people. Jesus certainly eats with all the right kinds of people all the time, but he's often accused of eating with the wrong kinds of people. Notice what the master does. He invites the right kind of people first. And only when rejected, when slighted, when disappointed, when he became angry, did he then invite the people on the margins. It doesn't sound like Jesus. And yes, Jesus is in the business of abundant meals. He's a glutton and a drunkard. But not only that, do you remember the story of the feeding of the 5,000 in the wilderness? And do you remember how that story ends, that everybody eats until they're full? And when it's all over, what do we learn is that there's still food left over. There's this abundance there. There's abundance here. Remember we talked about how they went out and got the poor and the disabled and the blind, and there's still room left over, and then they force more people to come in. I think there's a different kind of abundance here, an abundance that's about showing off all that you have, the wealth that you have, the power that you have, not an abundance that's about feeding people who need it most. I don't think this is a great dinner. I think it's a pretty terrible dinner because of the character of the inviter, one who only goes to those who can pay him back first, which is the opposite of what Jesus tells people to do right before this, right? He says, start with the people who can't pay you back. The landowner starts with people who can pay him back. It has to do with the character of who he is, that he seems more interested, the landowner, in filling his house so he can feel good about himself rather than feeding those who need it most. And moreover, this party seems more like a like an obligation. He's forcing people to come rather than inviting people with open hands. This story does not sound like the great feast that we might imagine in the kingdom of God, and it doesn't look like the meals Luke's Jesus has throughout the gospel. Maybe this isn't such a great dinner. It's not so great a dinner. It's great in one way. It's great by the rules Jesus seems to remake right before our story. It's great by the ordinary, everyday rules. There's lots of food. You invite the right people. It's great by the amount of food, the quality of the people first invited. But also it's great when it comes to the power of one man, the power that one man has over the enslaved and the disabled and the marginalized. So in one sense, yeah, it's a great dinner. There's a lot of food, there's a lot of money spent, and the person who's inviting gets to move people around just because he wants to. But it's not so great when it comes to Jesus and the kingdom. Jesus does not go to the margins as an afterthought, but as the first move he makes. Jesus does not have tiers in his invite list. Jesus' invite list is long and ever-growing and ever-open. I think a great dinner would look very, very different. I used the metaphor a couple weeks ago of the cross being a photo negative of the gospel. I think this is a photo negative of the great feast in the kingdom. A great dinner would start in the margins. A great dinner would feed those who need it most. A great dinner would be not about building up the inviter's social capital, but about sharing whatever they have. Even more, I think a great dinner would taste so different precisely because of who is there. The marginalized, the disabled, the poor, of course, but also the Jesus who makes them and us feel right at home. The landowner, the master, is not a picture of Jesus, but an opposite of the kind of the way that Jesus moves through the world and invites us to his table. So meals in Luke are central, they're important, and so are these parables, these stories meant to mess with us, to disrupt us, to help us see the world upside down and sideways and a little bit differently. And this is not such a great dinner, It's the opposite of what God calls us to imagine a gathering might look like. Questions, thoughts? Where might we go, please?
We worked this over Friday morning in our small group.
Awesome.
I wanted to share a couple
please. Of I learned so much from this, so I appreciate that, yeah.
First of all, the NSR, whatever it is, only uses slave, but the other translations use servant.
Mm-hmm.
The implication yeah. is more like Downton Abbey than Simon Luther.
Right, so... an observation. I'm going to repeat it as we go along, just for the sake of the people listening to the recording. Noticing that in the NRSV uses the word slave, and other translations tend to use the word servant. The difference being Downton Abbey and what was the
Simon Legree,
yeah, Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? So, right, yeah. So it's those other texts I think are trying to minimize the language that's here. But we'll talk more about that. Yeah. Yep. Good. Yeah. My dog ate the invitation. Yeah, yeah.
Someone in the group found that those three excuses are legitimate excuses for Deuteronomy.
Uh-huh.
That, and the implication, was it Tom or Keith?
Yeah, it's Deuteronomy 20. It's the rules of going to holy war.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, gather the people and they say, okay, now weep out the ones who have built the house but not dedicated.
Yeah.
The people who have planted a vineyard and not enjoyed the grapes.
Yeah. Yeah, helpful. So in this small group, they're reflecting on how Deuteronomy has certain rules about who goes to war and who doesn't. And here excluding folks who have recently bought property, who have not enjoyed it, who've recently gotten married. but also people who were too timid to go to that war, and might that fear might spread among the troops as well. Great connections, great insights. The implication being those are Old Testament reasons, these are as opposed to New Testament reasons. Good. So striking parallels there between the things that the parable outlines what we see in Deuteronomy. Jay, did you want to jump in that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. I have something more important
to go to. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I felt that resonated more with my experience.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, I love this God who invites me, but I have other more important things that I'll take up my time.
Yeah. Great. So a couple things on the Jade was sorry. I should repeat that. That for Jade, this was a striking parallel, right? So these are, if they are legitimate reasons, then it reflects our own lives when sometimes God invites us and we reject God because we think we have legitimate reasons as well. So on the language of slave and servant, so it's the same Greek term that's used for people who are clearly enslaved and the same term that's used for when Paul uses slavery as a metaphor for what it means to follow Christ. I think it's more important for us, I think in those translations, to use words like slave, or I think more and more people are using the language of enslavement to remind us that there's somebody actually enslaving these people. It's not just somebody who happened to become a slave, but someone who has power over them. I think the language of servant too often tries to soften the realities of folks living under ancient slavery. If you read enough commentaries, you'll see people sometimes saying, well, you know, ancient slavery wasn't as bad as modern slavery. It wasn't based on race. They weren't quite as mean to people along the way. But any system that says there are certain people who can own the labor and the lives of others is profoundly broken. So there's no better or worse. It's just terrible all the way down. And moreover, we have lots of evidence of the kind of abuse, violence, and especially sexual assault that would be faced by enslaved people even in the ancient world. When you own someone's labor, when you own someone's body, you can do whatever you want with them. So I think the realities of that life, and even the ways that the New Testament takes slavery for granted as a reality in the world, I think it's important for us to confront. So these lists in Deuteronomy is striking, right? So these are reasons not to go to war, although this isn't a war, it's just a dinner, right? So I think that's part of the ludicrousness of this is that just, at least in my mind, and again, the parables can be read a million different ways, so this isn't me telling you, this is just how I think I read it, right? That it's the taking of these reasons that are legitimate in Deuteronomy for not going to war, but it's just a dinner. It's just this kind of social obligation that we have with one another. At least that's how I read it there. So I saw a couple hands. See, who wants... I'm going to make a list, so Corey, here and here. All right. Corey, yeah.
Okay, so we talked about this in small groups on Monday, too, and this is a story, frankly, we teach to kids a lot. We use it as an illustration for communion oftentimes about how all are welcome to the table. But reading it again, our groups got a little hung up again on the character of the host. It isn't kind of a benevolent, gosh, they didn't want to come. Well, you all come and how lovely and fill the table. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fight in some ways. So you're going to have to help me out here. Is this parable also in Matthew? And does the host have the same character in Matthew?
Oh.
Or
is it kind of like a Lucan distinctive? Yeah.
Lucan resentment.
I'd have to look and double check it. Do you remember, Jade? Helps out, please.
I wrote a paper.
Great. I like having seminary students around. This is very helpful.
They
can come back.
And there is only the one guy who doesn't show up in the proper wedding garb who is.
Oh, it's the
hostile story.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But everyone else, it seems, who initially rejected gets to come.
Yeah.
But we don't see that second chance.
Yeah. Oh, so I should say, repeat. So the sense like there is this, the character of the host is what the small group got hung up on. That inviting out of resentment and not out of generosity or love. And then also a connection with the Matthew story is similar. So the character we learn is the same there, the character of the host, but that in Matthew there is a second chance given to some, but still some people show up with the wrong clothes and it's all apocalyptic and scary along the way. Lots of judgment involved there. Good. Please.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there you go.
No. Oh, almost. Oh. Is that there? There it is.
Blessed is anyone. Okay, one of the dinner guests. So it sounds to me like we're done with one story, mm-hmm. and this is the guy's reaction to it. And so is Jesus saying, wait a minute, you didn't get it? I have to elaborate on this. So he's basically saying, blessed is anyone is not what I was trying to teach you. Mm-hmm.
I think this is true, right? I think the statement is true on its own. Blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. Yes, of course. That's certainly true. And that I wonder if Jesus got a sense in this party, in this because right here he's, right, so in verse, at the beginning of 14, we learn that he's going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees. So here he's eating with the right kinds of people. So it may have to do with the setting of the people that he's talking to. It is folks, probably some social capital, some. And maybe he understands that the person doesn't quite get what he means, or he needs to drive the point further to say,
that's what I was wondering.
This isn't metaphorical, right? This isn't like invite the powerful people with less power. It's actually go to the margins of your community and start there. And he elaborates that with a further parable. I think that's what might be happening here.
Yeah, so the responder is basically okaying everything that Jesus just said.
He's saying, amen, Jesus.
We all agree.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's saying, I think he's saying, good one, Jesus, yes, blessed is anyone who eats. And but then Jesus wants to go further, and it may be that, does Jesus tell this parable meant to disrupt his audience, and they're a little too affirming of it, and he's like, okay, I got to go one more step, because I don't think you're getting this. That may be happening there. Is this related to this point, or a new point? Raise the light, let's go, yeah, we can talk about it. Oh, we covered it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, like somebody making peace. Yeah, let's, right, at the dinner table and we're having a political conversation. Let's all get along, right? So it's, blessed is anyone who will eat the bread of the kingdom of God. Let's move on. Let's talk about something else, Jesus. Yeah, maybe it's trying to move Jesus on. Yeah. You hear? Great.
So one comment is that this is given at a dinner and he's talking about a dinner.
Yeah.
I think the host might be rather uncomfortable.
Yeah. Right. Maybe the host would be uncomfortable because he's at a dinner telling the story about this terrible dinner. Yeah.
And Jesus wasn't the only one in his time who was telling parables. I mean, as far as I understand, very rich in the culture itself, the telling of parables.
Yes.
Did Jesus take those parables and sort of tell them in a way?
Good question. Great question.
How did they fit into the culture?
Yeah. So an observation that parables are not uncommon in the ancient world. It's not like Jesus invented the genre. And perhaps maybe didn't even invent these stories themselves either. Did he learn them from something else? Are these stories that he's reproducing or recreating? I don't know, but I imagine that there are stories that Jesus does make up in the moment. I think the way that Jesus is narrated in the Gospels is of a really powerful storyteller. And we know people like this, right, who can kind of weave a story at the drop of a hat. And that's kind of how Jesus is narrated in the Gospels. But I imagine, too, that he's being shaped by the stories he's already hearing, and that's telling stories that his audience might already know or might have heard before, but maybe giving a little twist, changing it just a little bit, would be really effective. So we don't know precisely all that, but I imagine that all those things might be true. He might make them up on the spot. He might tell an old story and tell it again. He might tell an old story and change it just a little bit to change the emphasis of the story. What is clear in the Gospels is that these stories are disruptive and are kind of weird, and often people don't know what to do with them. So our posture that we often have, again, because we've heard these stories so much, like, oh, I know how the story ends. We fill in the ending. Is not the original posture of the people hearing these stories for the first time. And it's hard, right? Because we can't just undo all that knowledge that we have, all that experience, and just go back to pretend that we've never read these stories before. But can we find ways for these stories to mess with us just a little bit?
This first story, which may be the real great dinner parable, ends with the idea that he should invite the board, etc., the margins, and this concept of, okay, I got it, I'll go do that,
yeah,
so that I get into the kingdom of God. So there's a different kind of repayment here.
Mm.
God repays because I can't.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So Jesus says, oh, yeah, you're not getting it.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to understand this isn't about repayment. This isn't about earning the kingdom.
Mm.
It's about who is your neighbor.
Yeah.
And how should you treat them? I see
nice.
The story
Good.
Sort of as an extension of this. Jesus constantly tries to tell us who our neighbor is.
Yeah.
And this is another one of those
uh-huh.
who is your neighbor
Good.
Story.
Yeah. So is the story about less about how we earn our way into this feast, into this kingdom, less about how we get there, and more about one, the character of the one inviting, but more, what if this is a question about who our neighbors are? And that when we make it about how I get in or how I stay in, we kind of miss the crucial part that it's about expanding our imagination about who our neighbors are. Yeah, we end up, what was the verb? We end up venting. Venting?
Vengeance.
Vengeance. We end up with vengeance, right? Sorry, with the mask. We try our best, right? We try our best. We end up with vengeance at the end instead of wide hospitality. Last one, I think. Yeah, please.
Is it not about getting into the kingdom, but helping Jesus create the kingdom?
Hmm. Good. So say a bit more about that. Is it not about getting into the kingdom, but helping Jesus create the kingdom? Can you say a little bit more, yeah?
He's telling you to bring in
uh-huh.
the marginalized.
Yeah.
That's what we need to do to create the kingdom so that they're all included.
Yeah. He's telling us to bring in the marginalized so that all might be included. I think I like that imagination, right? So it's less about how we can be like the landowner and throw a big dinner, and more about imagining the ways that Jesus is creating the kingdom around us. And I think here, even in this way, maybe it's less about our hospitality. So part of the challenge, I think, of living as we do as people largely with privilege in our own lives, like with resources and finances and social power and all that, is that we're really good at imagining how we might host other people, how we can be hospitable, and harder to imagine what it might be like to be hosted, what it might be like for us to be in need of that kind of receiving of hospitality. So I think, for example, so my wife Holly has been working some with the family of Afghan refugees, and part of the thing that I've been struck by in hearing her tell stories about it is just trying to imagine what that might be like for us. What would it be like for us to have to flee from our homes and be used to a certain kind of life and then land somewhere else and have to depend on others for the everyday stuff of life, or like, buying groceries, driving yourself somewhere, even like just how to read food labels. Like if the language is different and the assumptions of the world are different, what would that even look like? And I think for a lot of us, and for me, I'll say, it's easier for me to imagine what it'd be like to host somebody like that, to help somebody, and less so to imagine myself displaced and in need of help. So that shift in imagination might be important too, that it isn't always just about us going to the margins, bringing folks in, but maybe going to the margins. And I wonder if we might spot there the richness that's found in those places. So not just, I think sometimes we assume that when we go to the margins, what we're going to find is a lot of need that I can go fill. And we forget that at the margins, among the poor, among the disabled, among all these folks, are actually deep resources. Maybe not financial as we would expect, or maybe not social as we demand, but rich resources of survival and persistence that we might need quite desperately. So the assumption that at the margins is not just loss, but is also a great resource. Last comment, and then we have to have coffee. Yeah, the enslaved are not invited to the feast. Are they beyond the pale here? Is that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, in the way that Jesus even and the story is talking about who is on the margins, are the enslaved kind of beyond the imagination of the text?
Or are they enslaved beyond the imagination of the text as part of the margins that we've been talking about? They're conduits, right? So the enslaved person, nobody has a name here, but their role is not to have emotions or feelings or wants, but just to go from one space to another and do the thing that someone else has asked them to do. So here we run into the limitations of a story, right? A story can't do all the things, but what it can do is provoke these kinds of questions for us, and maybe for us to notice not just the folks with power and the folks on the margins, but the really invisible folks that find themselves either traveling between those two spaces or in somewhere in between those two spaces. That's easier for us to imagine what somebody in utter depravity looks like and somebody who's got all the power in the world, but folks caught in between those two poles, maybe that's something that Jesus' story doesn't address specifically, but might provoke us to ask that question about those spaces as well. All right, really, last comment. Thank you.
Mm. So maybe there's a problem that they're not invited, but Jesus is like identifying himself as a person.
So if we do read it allegorically, and the master is God in some way, and the invited are us in some way, is Jesus the enslaved person making their way between these spaces and bringing us in? So here's part of the power of these stories, is that, again, we don't read them just one way. And part of that, the disruptive part of these stories is precisely these kinds of questions we ask. Well, what about the enslaved person? Who's that in this story? Wonderful. Thank you all. I think we're at time. We're going to go to the Beatitudes next week and talk about the Jesus Sermon on the Plain in Luke chapter 6 next week. So we will see you then. Thanks, friends. We'll see you then.